Dewey's here at Groundswell this year, the 26th and 27th of June, close to London, UK. Many friends of the podcast will be there. John Kempf, Abby Rose, Benedict Boezel, Henry Dimbleby, Claire Hill, Russ Carrington, Andy Cato, Tim Coates, and many, many more. See you there. Finally, after 3 years, a check-in with Bert Glover of Impact Ag Partners in Australia, who over the last years, for investors, has put over $600 million to work on farms using regenerative practices and implementing regenerative practices. They managed to sell some of the world's first soil carbon credits to Microsoft and are launching an Australian-focused fund. So why, with all these achievements and all this work to do in Australia, did he decide to also start operations in North America? What does he see happening with the soil carbon markets, and where will the market of biodiversity credits go to? And I'm talking about geese in this interview, which obviously have to be ducks. I'm very, very sorry. So ducks, not geese. Enjoy. This is the Investing in Regenerative Agriculture and Food podcast, Investing as if the planet mattered, where we talk to the pioneers in the regenerative food and agriculture space to learn more on how to put our money to work to regenerate soil, people, local communities, and ecosystems while making an appropriate and fair return. Why my focus on soil and regeneration? Because so many of the pressing issues we face today have their roots in how we treat our land and our sea, grow our food, what we eat, wear, and consume. And it's time that we as investors, big and small, and consumers start paying much more attention to the dirt / soil underneath our feet. To make it easy for fans to support our work, we launched our membership community, and so many of you have joined us as a member. Thank you. If our work created value for you, and if you have the means, and only if you have the means, consider joining us. Find out more on gumroad.com/investing in regen ag. That is gumroad.com/investing in regen ag. Or find the link below. Welcome to another episode. Today, a very special one. We have Bert Glover back on the podcast. We interviewed him twice in 2019. And that feels like a long time ago, which it is. I mean, it's 3 years, actually to the day, 3 years, we released the first interview. And there's so much to catch up on. There's so much work that has been done on the ground at different continents, actually. So I'm very, very much looking forward to catching up, to talk about the different technologies we discussed last interview, because I will put it in the links below as well. We did a full interview just on tech with a lot of virtual fencing, actually, which since then we've unpacked more and more. So I'll put all those links below. But first of all, welcome back, Bert.
Thanks, Cohen. Thanks for having me. It's great to be back. Lots happened in 3 years.
I mean, we do check in every now and then. It's not that we didn't talk for 3 years, but we didn't talk on air. We didn't record it. So I'm very much looking forward. Let's do a very brief intro into Impact Ag Partners for the people that didn't listen to the other interviews. Obviously, go and listen to them. Not now. I mean, stay here with us. But in a few sentences, what is Impact Ag Partners? And then we're going to unpack a bit what has happened or what has changed in the last 3 years.
Well, lots changed, Cohen. I mean, you know, there's been a lot happening with pandemics and geopolitical issues. And again, it comes back to why we believe agriculture has got such an important role globally. We, in terms of climate change, you know, there's so many pressures on food systems and the environment. We think agriculture is a great solution and can be take a leading role in tackling climate change by building resilience towards its impacts and through decarbonizing the atmosphere and our economies. And so with some of the global challenges that we're facing as a society, we believe agriculture can play a major role in a lot of those and really impact ag partners.
You just don't believe that, actually. Yeah, you've been working on that, I think, for 10 years plus now. Like, I think a lot of people on this podcast believe that the agriculture is a big part of the solution, but going from belief until putting hundreds of millions to work, because that's what you've done, there's quite a step in between. So where would you describe Impact Ag Partners now as we're talking, what is it, May 2022? Depending on when you listen to this, obviously. Let's say spring in the Northern Hemisphere, 2022, where does Impact Ag Partners stand?
So, you know, we currently manage over $600 million of assets under management across Australia, and we've now, you know, as you alluded to, we've expanded into the US. You know, there's 500,000 acres under management, and it's a lot broader than what it was 3 years ago, Cohen. You know, we've got permanent tree nut crops. We've got, you know, wheat, barley cropping in Western Australia. We've got ranch in the US. We've got carbon projects, renewable projects, biodiversity projects. We've done green finance deals. We've sold soil carbon. A lot's happened in 3 years. And if you think about what was in that last podcast around, I think I probably spoke to you about environmental finance, and I spoke to you about monetizing soil carbon. Well, you know, we've probably done the very first of some of those for us as a firm, and some of those were first in the world. So we're really proud of what we've done. We've got a lot of work to do. You know, we haven't got all the answers. We're trying really hard. We're scaling up. I've got a fantastic team of 10 people here in Australia, plus on the ground staff that manage our farms, who are all amazing. And, you know, a team of 3 or 4 in the US. So trying to demonstrate what we do globally, Cohen. We believe some of the things we've learned and practiced here in Australia can have global impact. And we feel like we're getting really prepared to try and help demonstrate the role that agriculture can play in terms of food security, landscape management, addressing climate change and how we manage grasslands, and, you know, bringing more, you know, financial returns as well back to the farm gate, so that farmers can reinvest in their farms, reinvest in their assets. And this helps, you know, fund things like carbon projects, like development, like improved biodiversity, improvement in waterways. And so we're excited. As you can tell, we're scaling up. And where do you want to start?
Let's start with, how did that happen? Because how did the move, let's say, or the growth to another continent happen? Because Australia is very big, as many people know. There's a lot of work to be done there. You could have stayed there, not stayed there. You could have worked there for many more decades before you were quote unquote done, or the regeneration is complete, which it never is. But you decided to make your life a bit more complicated, be in different time zones with different teams on the ground in different continents. How did that happen, and why did you decide to become also active in North America?
Good question. There's three main reasons, but I think the word you used that resonates with me the most is why. And the reason why, it goes back to our fundamental core values as a business and what we believe in and really what we want to achieve. And for us, if we can help be a thought leader around how agriculture can play a major role in decarbonizing the atmosphere, producing nutrient-dense food, and demonstrating how livestock have a critical role to play in landscapes, and the role that external capital can play in catalyzing that change, I felt like by going to North America and potentially going a bit broader globally, just maybe we can take some of our learnings and share those. Maybe we can share some of our successes and also share some of the things that haven't worked so well. We're quite transparent. We're very data-centric, so we can, you know, show our performance with data. But we talk about creating a ripple effect through societies and through industries, and hopefully have an impact on some governments about how we think we can approach the production of food and fiber different. And I felt like we had to get a footprint in the US. So going back to your question, one reason.
So where do you start then? Like, how do you start that? Like, feeling like you should have, and it makes a lot of sense. Things get more real if you can see and touch them, and as long as they're for many people far away in Australia, we can always say, yeah, but it works there because there's a government that supports something, or they have different climate or soil. And all of those things are not true and true at the same time. So to show it somewhere else, like, look, we can replicate somewhere else as well, is very, very, very strong. But then the step to do it and start managing large farms, because these are hundreds of thousands of acres. This is not, let's start a market garden somewhere, which is also not easy, but this is definitely on the scale of not easiness quite high. Like, where do you start then, going from what would be nice to start something in North America to actually buying your first property, start managing land, hiring people? Like, what was the first step there?
I think the first step was getting investor confidence. And investor confidence came off the back of the fact that we generated primarily soil carbon off assets here in Australia. We had the data to back it up. We did the deal with Microsoft selling the soil carbon credits. And I think, you know, the pandemic changed a lot about investor perception around how we grow food in relation to nature.
Really? What's the biggest advantage? So. Like, what do you, or not advantage, what's the biggest surprise, or how do you see that the pandemic has changed that? Is it you get more phone calls, you get better, more interesting phone calls, you get more deeper conversations about the role of land and livestock, or what do you see when you say it has changed? How does that manifest itself?
I think what the impact was, that the pandemic slowed everyone down. And that is people that live in cities, you know, and let's think about the capital flows that come to Impact Ag, you know, investors sitting at home, thinking about where their food comes from, thinking about, if things get worse, do I have a vegetable garden? Where do I source my food from? How's it got here into my house? And in some cases,
freezer full of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And in some cases, you know, people were locked up because there was lockdowns in different parts of the world. So, you know, they didn't have their freedoms. They had their food, they had their family. And it was a humbling experience for many people. And I think what happened was that we started to think about, you know, how did the disease around, you know, COVID happen, humanity getting closer to nature. And then you, investors thinking about, well, you know, how does food production interact with nature, and what is the outcomes of that for nature, and how are we going to interact with nature moving forward? And on top of that, you got this whole climate change discussion, and then COP26 happened as well. And so I think it seems like there's been a little bit of a reset, and even I've seen traveling since borders have opened up, both in the, you know, US and here in Australia.
You got investors that got interested and more comfortable in these kind of investments, and you took them basically to say, okay, let's focus on getting a foothold in North America. And currently, what are you managing there? Like, in terms of, is it equal the size of what you're managing in Australia? Is it smaller? Is it bigger? Like, what is the, or everything is bigger in the US, so it must be bigger. Like, what's the current ratio, let's say, Australia versus US for you?
So the US, it's probably, you know, 40 or 50% of, you know, what we're doing here in some regard. I mean, from an area point of view, it's a large amount of area. 300,000 acres in America. So that's quite a footprint. But in terms of the business and intensity, it's nowhere near as intense as some of the Australian businesses, and it's primarily a large cattle ranch. So, you know, it's not diversified, and, you know, it's not row crop. It's primarily beef production in a semi-arid environment, which has cold winters. So that creates some different thinking that's going to be required for us, especially with our focus on natural capital and soil carbon sequestration. So, you know, it's going to be a good challenge for us. We're already making some good headway, but it's really exciting, and I'm hoping that we can take a lot of our learnings. Some of our specialist team have already been there. We've got some great plans. We've got some new pilots we're already starting to roll out there, working with universities. So, you know, it's a good move. It's a substantial move for us. It's large enough for it to be efficient and effective, and, you know, it could be a great launching pad for us, but also a great demonstrator of how we can go about things to address climate change and food production. So it's exciting.
And so what
for
are
us.
The differences? What are the differences you see now in like ranching, like let's say a farm or ranch you bought in Australia and the one you now bought or you're managing for your investors in the US? Like what does the implementation look like? What are you going to do there? Is it very different from what you're used to in Australia, or is it relatively simple? Like, look, we have the guidebook, the recipe book. We perfected it over the last years. Of course, it's a different regulatory environment, etc. But we know step 1 to 10 really, really like intensity goes up, or we do different grazing systems. We need to get in fed. Like, what does it look like on the ground? I try to describe it as visually as possible, because I think it's difficult to understand the sheer size. And then what livestock there can do, or what role it could play, which what you obviously have shown in Australia.
Yeah, so I guess the first thing to say is that the core principles that we stand by, the practices we implement, our tactics, they're all very transferable. So we stick to those. We've got the playbook. We've got the processes and the systems. We can roll this out pretty much everywhere. It's just we're in different climates in the US, different landscapes, different culture, as you said, different regulatory environment, a lot more complex, Cohen. So, you know, environmental groups, you know, dealing with wildlife, just different. And I think for us, dealing with, you know, different climates, so dealing with winter, dealing with snowpack, dealing with elevation, you know, we're learning, but we're transferring the same principles and the same practices. It's just in a different environment, different climate, more stakeholders that are involved and have an opinion and have a say. So it's exciting. And we're really up for it. I'm really excited about what we could do there. And I think too, for us, being so close to so many consumers in the US is really exciting for us. So one of the parts of the puzzle that we feel a little bit as pioneers in this space that we haven't cracked, we feel like we've got enough background and evidence now around soil carbon, biodiversity credits, renewables on farm, you know, premiumization of carbon credits, these sorts of things. We feel like we've got some knowledge and some experience and expertise, and we've demonstrated that. What we probably haven't done enough of yet, due to the kind of the demographics and the markets in Australia, is that we haven't quite premiumized enough of the food and the fiber that we produced. So that's always been an ambition of ours to try and attract a premium for food that's produced in an environmentally and socially conscious way. And so we feel like the fact that we're all of a sudden in a country that has, you know, so many more, 10 times more the consumers, and wealthier consumers most probably in some key cities. That's exciting for us, because if we can bring those premiums back to the farm gate, you remember on our first podcast, that was my kind of golden wish. If I could bring more, you know,
margins,
better returns back to the farmers so they could reinvest in their assets, that to me, that's gold.
And are you planning or thinking, like, are you going to set up your own brand, which of course in the US is very competitive market, let's say? Are you going to partner with some of the ones? Like, well, how do you see that happening or playing out over the next years to make sure that those premiums, that hard-earned premiums, are flowing back to the farm and not get lost in the commoditization of many of those markets, which you might be more prone to in Australia, where a lot of this is going to export because it's a relatively small local market. And then, of course, setting up supply webs and lines that are premiumized is very, very difficult. Now you're in a market that is, I mean, relatively close, quote unquote, but it feels a lot closer. What do you see there? What's your role there? Is it going to be, which directions do you see it taken? Is it this big enough to set up your own brands? Are you going to do on-site slaughtering and processing? What do you feel there are next steps you want to explore? Obviously, imagining you haven't figured out the whole piece here yet.
That's right. Haven't figured all the pieces of the puzzle out yet. But I mean, I can share with you what we are thinking about. And what we are thinking about is we think we've got a great story to tell. We feel like we have some elements that could make up a really great brand around carbon neutrality and product origination. And I feel like, due to the size of the market and our target market, that we will most probably start, and we have started, to have discussions around partnerships with people with existing brands, but they want that next level of sort of brand awareness, or taking a new product to brand that says something about carbon neutrality, environmental services, single origin, premium product. So we've started those conversations and we're thinking about our production systems so that we can feed into that supply chain. And so it's very early. And in my experience, you might remember we spoke about a vertically integrated business we had in Australia around grass-fed beef. So in my experience, we need a really robust, here's this word, resilient supply chain that can deliver the quality and quantity that you need to support a brand. So we will focus on the supply side probably considerably in the next, 1 to 2 years, but we've already started the discussions around partnerships and what the product needs to be to create brands with those partners. So, that's kind of our strategy so far, but we're only 6 months into the journey.
Do you want to learn how to invest, or are you an entrepreneur and want to build companies in the regenerative food and agriculture space? Or do you work in big ag and big food and want to really move the needle? We have developed a new video course for you. Find out more on investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/course or in the show notes description below. And let's start to unpack a bit of the carbon side of things and the natural capital. First, carbon. I mean, you were instrumental in the deal with Microsoft. And we had actually Christian of Regen Network. I will link the interview below as well. So how did that happen? Probably the first soil carbon credit sold internationally, or sold even in generally, to a very high-profile buyer, obviously. How did that happen? And then what happened since then? Or how do you see that? You talked about biodiversity credits as well. Like, let's start to unpack the natural capital side a bit. But let's start with the carbon deal, the soil carbon deal that happened, I think, a year and a half ago, maybe, or a year ago. I don't remember the exact details.
Yeah, February, I think it was February 21. So, yeah, a bit over 12 months. So I guess going back to the thought, and I think I explained last time about we are quite a data-centric business, and we have had, since about 2010, consistent soil data taken in the same GPS location, across some ranches, using the same lab to test our soil all of this time. And off the back of this data set, and actually after meeting Christian and in San Francisco, actually, where I think I saw you in 2019. Yeah. So we were on at that point in time, we were actually on a bit of a mission to find the best technology to measure soil carbon, the best markets that we wanted to partner with to sell soil carbon, and who we thought the leaders were in this emerging space. And spending time with Christian, and we went and met four or five other parties whilst we were there, a colleague of mine, the head of our natural capital division, off the back of that and with the data we had, we felt like we knew the amount of carbon we'd kind of sequestered. We knew the trend line from our ranches. And so off the back of that and with satellite data to verify the what had also happened, we were able to sell what you call vintage carbon. So it was carbon that was generated between 2017 and 2020. So it was 3 years of carbon. We call it vintage carbon. So it wasn't carbon that we were going to sequester in the future. It's carbon that we already had sequestered. And so that's what we worked with Christian and Toby and my team, worked with Christian's team to help validate that. And we had some third parties audit that as well. And Microsoft had their own DD team on this. So it was the relationship with Christian and the Regen network. And then those guys approached Microsoft when Microsoft, you know, you may have seen they put out expressions of interest. They chose our product. You might be aware that, you know, Microsoft have a commitment to offset emissions back to 1972. And they wanted a terrestrial-based carbon credit solution to go in their bucket of offsets for that cohort. And it just so happened that we were about the only one that had a chunk of carbon off three assets that we managed here in Australia. So that was great. We didn't sell all the credits. We sold a percentage. The deal was done and it was great. So I think your question was what's next or what's the future?
Yeah, since then, what happened? Yeah. Because I'm imagining the phone started ringing since the press releases went out. And what has happened since then? Let's start on the carbon side first and then we go to the rest of the natural capital stack.
Yeah, so the phone did ring and it was large global emitters that are in the oil and gas sector, trading houses that wanted to trade carbon, institutional banks, investors. We had people saying, we're flying up in the morning. We want to talk to you about some credits. And we're saying, don't fly anywhere. Don't leave home. Like, we've got no more to sell you just right now. And so since then we have, you know, so that was a private market deal that we did with Microsoft. Since then we have continued to generate under the same protocol carbon. So we can credit again under the same method with Regen Network, and we most probably will either this year or next. So that's what we've been doing with carbon in the under that private protocol. We've also registered under the Australian government method as well. We've got, I think, three projects registered under that as well. So we've taken on that. We've been involved in supporting the government in helping sort of iron out some of their initial issues around permanence and crown cover and carbon, what we call carbon stacking. And so they're making legislative changes to enable more farmers to participate in the Australian government regulated soil carbon method, because there was just a few too many barriers to entry, and one being cost to participate, primarily the cost of the soil testing. So we've registered more projects and continue to sequester carbon. And then, you know, we will start crediting when we think it's financially feasible to credit on those new projects.
And just to mention, like, basically there is a regulated market in Australia on soil carbon, so a below ground. How has that been going in terms of, is it been interesting in terms of pricing for you? Like, this comes out of the Australian government's pockets, or because it doesn't get sold to Microsoft, etc. This is a public project basically to incentivize farmers. Has it been interesting so far? Have you sold anything? Has it been important for the returns, or has it been mostly also helping to build this example as well, just as you mentioned before? Because I think it's the only one in globally where there is a regulated market for soil carbon that is public and not voluntary like you see in many other places.
Yeah, so it is public, and we haven't sold anything in that market as yet. And you're right, it is the government has been the market as well, and they have created an auction, and they've had a reverse auction, and they've also been the regulator. So just recently they've said that they don't feel like they can be the market and the regulator, which is, you know, from a conflict and governance point of view, it's the right thing. So that has had an impact on the Australian government, what we call ACCU market, Australian Carbon Credit Unit market. It's had an impact on that. It's primarily saying we're now letting the market go private, and that has had an impact on price. The price has come off. I think that's probably a short-term change in price. I'm sure, you know, it will sort of get momentum back to where it was and maybe even excel. But that's where we're at. We're getting a lot better in Australia with the government around what we call stacking. So not only can you, on one farm or one piece of land, not only can you have a soil carbon project, you can now also have a veg carbon project. And we're hoping that when this is finally legislated, you'll be able to also have your, if you want to do a cattle herd methodology or a savanna burning methodology, you could, so in theory, you may be able to have one, two, maybe three different carbon projects on the one parcel of land. And that's when the returns get somewhat interesting.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Let's talk about the returns first and then about the carbon potential, what you've been seeing. So has this been like also the deal with Microsoft, which I don't think the price was released, but has it been significantly interesting, or has it been so far like for the returns on like on a ranch level, because you're managing this obviously for investors? I don't think any of your models or investing models are based purely on the carbon side or selling off credits. It's based on production. It's based on margins. It's based on markets and premium markets, as you mentioned now. How important has this natural capital selling been? And where does it go? Like, is this going to be an interesting profit driver for landowners at some point? Or is it already the case, maybe?
Well, under some methods, so we have a method in the Australian government system here called HIR. It's human-induced revegetation. And primarily it's to stop farmers clearing land of woody vegetation. And under that method, that the carbon market has pretty much now underpinned that whole business model. So that, you know, there is funds and investors that are buying assets in Australia purely to put into a HIR project, and the returns are purely from the carbon. And those returns are very, you know, respected in the market. We've bought some of those assets for investors, but it's not really our bread and butter in terms of where we want to see impact. We think soil carbon is where we can have the most impact and is best for climate. And if we're going to be nature positive, we think in the soil carbon markets is the place to go. And so back when we did the soil carbon deal, we're seeing annual cash yield, you know, upticks of say 40 basis points, and in some, off some farms up to 100 basis points. So on an annual cash yield basis. So, and that's at a price that's, you know, in the teens, let's call it. We're now talking about prices that are in the mid to high 20s. So maybe, you know, you start getting 50, 60 basis points on an annual basis just from one carbon project, a soil carbon project. So it's starting to be more significant depending where you are. And if the price continues to rise, you know, if we follow Europe as an example.
I think we're at 100 per, yeah.
100 you're 100 per euros, I think. Yeah. I think you're 100 euros. So that becomes substantial. And don't forget, one of the key core drivers here is to improve soil health. So whilst you might be monetizing excess carbon once you've offsetted your emissions, but your asset base is becoming more resilient at the same time. You're storing more water, your soil's healthier, your plants should be healthier, and you should be producing healthier food. So it's becoming significant. It's still complex. You need specialists to help you with it. We're building out our team, doing more in this space, but it's exciting for farmers that are doing the right thing.
And is it one of the reasons you also wanting to be closer to consumers, in this case, actually consumers of carbon soil carbon credits and other credits, like being in the US, putting you closer to the Microsoft of this world. Is that, was that a strategic move also there to see, okay, can we get closer to a voluntary market, but a market that is potentially willing to pay? I mean, we have the Stripes of this world that are doing a lot of experimental work and paying significant prices per ton. With the interview with Jim Mann, I think on enhanced rock weathering and biochar, they are at 50 or 100 and 200 per ton. Like, was that the reason to go to the US as well and be closer to that market, not just the market of the produce and the products you produce?
Yeah, for sure. So we're always challenging ourselves around, can we solve someone's problem? And I think for some large corporates in the private sector in the US, we can solve their carbon challenges, or their, more so their emissions problems. And I feel like there is an opportunity for a firm like us to partner with some big corporations and deliver ongoing carbon credits to offset some of their emissions. I think it may underpin and or enable us to raise capital off long-term commitments with some of those partners in the US. So we'll be talking to more of those partners around solving some of their problems through a nature-based solution and being nature positive. So I hope I answered your question, but the answer is yes.
Absolutely. And then to switch a bit to the carbon potential from all the different crops you mentioned, the different soil types, etc., and all the measurements you do, where do you see the largest carbon potential? Because of course, if you go and talk to Microsoft or to others, and they would say, okay, what do we need to do? Of course, we need to produce the food, but what systems do we need to put in place, depending where you are, that see that, is that the silver pasture that we see in drawdown? Is it the regenerative grazing? Like, what have you seen in the field with doing all these measurements that really is there something that stands out, and what is the potential there? Like, is it worth the hype we're having now, basically, on soil carbon? Or is there a bit more nuanced message that comes out of the field?
I think if, in our experience, I mean, and others will have other experiences, but in our experience, what excites me the most is, you know, I think the planet is covered something like 50% grasslands or 60% grasslands or savanna, right? So there's all these plants out there that if only we could stimulate them with livestock more, we could sequester more carbon. So for me, it's a no-brainer. And that's why we're so passionate about the role that livestock play in ecosystems, is that we think that they're the key to taking a low value product, as in savanna grass, a lignin, high content lignin product, and convert it into nutrient dense protein, being beef, whilst at the same time asking these plants to function and work and draw down carbon and sink that excess carbon exudate into soil. For us, that's where the real opportunity is. We also, so that's kind of at a macro level, and that's where we've got experience, and that's where we've got, you know, track record, so to speak. What we are looking at the moment is we like some of the permanent tree crops. And so in Australia, as an example, we're testing out macadamias because they're a native tree. They do, on a per hectare basis or a per acre basis, sequester and store in their biomass a large amount of carbon as well. So there is some specific plant species that we like to focus on from a carbon point of view. But, you know, again, all of these models have got to stack up financially for investors, and we have to demonstrate good financial returns. So in that sort of lens, we're open to other opportunities because we are looking to diversify and I guess manage our carbon risk, our generation risk as well.
And do you see a role, I mean, this sounds like different properties, but a role of integration there as well between the, like, going towards a more silver pasture system, like an integration of trees in agriculture and livestock operations? Have you done that, or do you see it, or is that too complex still to do that on the scales you operate?
I think, so when it comes to the integration, for us, I look at the
like, does it help the tree to grow better, faster, like if the grass around is managed by animals? Like, is there, I mean, there's a lot of research obviously on that, mostly on smaller scale. I'm getting for sure emails now, but like what do you see that from, like, putting your financial glasses on? Is it something you would like to do and see potential in?
Yeah, we see potential in it. We'd like to do it. We think it stacks up from an environmental point of view, and I think from an efficiency point of view, it just, to us, it makes sense. So in these intensive tree crops, I think the integration for me of choice is birds, and we haven't quite worked out.
I didn't expect that sound. Like, okay, birds. So you mean as in poultry? And I think I was like, what is he going to say? Birds, as in some birds coming in? Like, what are you planning there, bird?
Yeah, yep. It's poultry. It might be, it might be chickens for meat or eggs or turkeys or something along those lines. But I think, large animals or even pigs and sheep. My team are telling me it's getting more and more complex to have them in the system. Could be wrong, but just with the way we harvest and the things we do in those intensive tree environments, I think birds may be the go there. And so we're interested in exploring that. I think financially it'll make some sense, because what we mainly find, if wherever we bring in an animal into an existing system and use them as a tool, it makes us more efficient. It brings down our cost, and it produces a cleaner product. So we're all for that.
I've heard very interesting things on geese, actually, because I think it's the only one that can be fully raised on pasture. It doesn't need outside, doesn't need grain, etc., like many poultry need. And shout out to, I think it's one of the only organic geese egg producers in the UK that reached out recently. Anyway, I learned a lot on the video they shared, so thank you for, I hope they're listening to this one as well. But there's very interesting roles for animals on the farm. And then let's tackle a big one. What do you say when people say, of course, the livestock can, or not of course, let's say livestock can store X amount of carbon. What about the methane? What is your natural response? You must get this question all the time. Let's say, especially ruminants get a very bad rep, especially the cow, even worse. What do you say when people bring up the methane elephant in the room, let's say?
Yeah, it's a good one, and it's an interesting one, because I guess, and that's a little bit why we have focused on sequestration as opposed to emissions up until now. Now, I say that living in Australia. If I was in Europe, I would be saying something different, because I think it's my understanding that the focus is a lot more on emissions as opposed to sequestration, but that's my personal view that I don't have a lot of data to back that up. So to answer your question, I think for us, we like to think that we can sequester more than what we're emitting, and we've demonstrated that.
Positive, yeah.
Yeah, and you do that through life cycle assessment, and we wouldn't have carbon credits to sell if we didn't do that, and if we didn't produce more than we emitted. I think there's definitely an interesting piece of industry work and experimentation to come out of what we're doing around asparagopsis and seaweed in the beef sector. We're actually, not only is it happening in Australia, but we're actually doing something with UC Davis out of California on the ranches we have in the US around feeding seaweed in a grass-fed system. So not just in a feed yard, we're doing that as well, but we're doing one in a grass-fed system as well to see what the emissions is in that environment, and can we raise cattle in a grass-fed system with asparagopsis, and what's the emissions reduction in that environment. And, so I think that's a real solution.
How do you measure that? Because I've seen, I think most of the research on methane has been done historically in closed environments, so the CAFO operations. Like, I've seen very little outside or grassland ones, because I think it's very tricky to do. And that sort of leads to a potential question of, if all of this data is based on grain fat and soy fat cows, it might be that the methane is a lot lower if it's a diverse grass fat system. what we'll never know is we don't do that actual burping research. And could all this research on the methane and all of these bars where the cow is, of course, the worst thing of the climate we ever did, be based on of the standard of the industry, which is CAFO. But that might put the regenerative ranching ones in the wrong corner. Like they're being accused of something that might not be even be happening because the cows are much healthier. They're not burping so much. There's not a lot of methane being produced. I think some research of Ross Conser showed that there's a significant reduction if cows are healthy, and cows are in a good grassland situation, cows are much healthier, and you lose about 80% of the methane emission, which is a lot. And so is that, I feel that we're not really comparing apples and apples there. Have you seen that as well? Like, what's the discussion there to like in the deeper weeds as soon as you start wanting to sell these credits, because people will ask those questions.
Yes. And that's exactly why we want to do this. You know, there's two reasons why we really want to do this research with UC Davis. One is we want to see if the product works in the feedlot environment, and we do want to compare it to the grassland natural grazing system. So they'll both run side by side. Both trials will have controls and those animals within the trial. So that will be great. The other thing is that if you take a step back, Cohen, majority of livestock still spend a large majority of their time in grasslands. So if we don't solve the emissions problem for livestock whilst they're on grasslands, then we're not really solving the emissions that come out of, let's face it, agriculture. Majority of them, you know, livestock are a big contributor to agriculture's emissions. So if it's true that there's a large number of livestock out in grasslands globally, then we have to have a solution to reduce the methane in that environment. So if these trials are successful, and you asked how do you measure them, well, we have this thing called a green feeder, where when an animal puts their head in and into a feeder, the feeder has a reader for an RFID tag, and it determines whether the animal is in the trial or part of the control group. And when it puts its head in, then the feeder either drops some feed that the animal likes. So, you know, it's obviously high in energy and or salt. And if it's part of the trial group, it also gets asparagopsis. But if it's not, it doesn't. The other thing it does is whilst it's in there, it measures the hydrogen, methane, and also the CO2 of the animal while it's in there feeding. So that's how we get the numbers. And that data is pushed up in the cloud, and it can be seen in real time, all of those emissions out of that animal. So that's really interesting, and that's how we're going to see.
And then how do you do that in the field? Like, how do you do that if the cow like bends down to start nibbling on the grass and gets that interaction going with the roots and the soil carbon, it's being released, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like, how do you measure it there? Like, how do we, because this is in an inside environment, I understand, because there we have the sensors, but out on the field, when the cow is actually self-selecting whatever he or she wants to eat, like, how do we then add the seaweed to that, and how do we make it a fair comparison?
So
I don't know the answer. I'm just wondering, like, how do we do that? Yeah.
So just to be clear, and so I may not have explained that correctly, these feeders are going to be out in the pasture. So the animals are going to be eating grass, but they've also got access to the feeder. So I think it's the first time this kind of trial's been done in that environment. And that's what we're really interested in, to seeing the outcomes of that.
Super interesting. No, it's very interesting, the whole methane discussion, because I've yet to meet someone who's deep into, I mean, obviously because they're biased, but into livestock and into the potential, that is really worried about the methane part. And it seems mostly people that are not connected to agriculture are very worried about it. And I see now finally a bit more attention for the methane coming off, I mean, the flaring, et cetera, but also the methane coming off of the fertilizer used in the chemical fertilizer. Like, there's a lot of methane that's not connected to livestock, and which might be a lot easier to solve. But anyway, on closing the methane part, so you're going to do some very fundamental research, a research that has never been done before. Do you see then taking it to the next levels, let's say, or the natural capital stack, What has been happening in water and biodiversity, what you've seen, like the other big, maybe even bigger topics? Like if we run a, like carbon is a nice side benefit from increasing biodiversity and water storage. What have you seen there? Has the market been waking up? Do we see proper management? Have you sold something or do you see interest coming to, because it seems like biodiversity is getting a bit more a buzz at least, but have you seen that too?
Yeah, I think there's a little bit more buzz there. I don't think the markets have really matured greatly. I think measuring biodiversity has still become somewhat of a challenge. We have actually sold some credits off one of our farms in Australia to a large utility company that needed to buy some offsets. And those offsets, those biodiversity offsets, were relatively high value because on one of our farms, just based on our management, we, you know, our large rotational grazing, as you know, supports biodiversity and regeneration of plants. It just so happened that we regenerated a native grass species that was historically native to the area and had been missing from the environment for years and years, but under our management, you know, this native grass came back and it increased the value of the biodiversity credit. So I think there is small pockets of biodiversity credits being sold. Valuing it, I think, has still got some work to do. I mean, we've been offered off one farm here in Australia, the farm might be, say, 20,000 acres. We've been offered something like $40 million for the biodiversity credits off that farm that have been generated. It's one thing to have the credits and the value on them. It's another thing to take them to the market. So, you know, whether you get paid for that biodiversity value is still yet to be seen in full. We've seen it in, and we've been paid for in isolated cases. But for big chunks of biodiversity credits, we haven't done a big deal with that yet. And not to say that that won't happen, but I'm interested to see if the market does meet us where it is, you know, in theory valued at.
And do you see it as almost more important than carbon? Do you see it as equal or could it be, because this whole carbon focus, like very single-minded focus on carbon seems a bit off. If you look at a landscape, you look at a farm, if you look at it holistically, what is yours? Or because it seems easier to measure, which maybe it isn't even, but the carbon piece have been hyped so much in a sense, we have to fight carbon and climate change, so we have to. Carbon is the enemy, et cetera, et cetera. What is missing on the framing almost of biodiversity to get it to the same level of attention? Because we lost 60-70% of insect cover, we lost I don't know how many plants, most of them not even named. Like that seems to be almost the real crisis we're not really willing to face.
Well, it's really interesting, isn't it? Because there's been all this, as you say, hype about carbon and it's linked to climate change and global warming. And it just so happens that, you know, the big industries, the big companies globally, governments have realized that, you know, they're going to have to reduce emissions, so they buy carbon offsets. That creates a market and, to your point, all the hype. But it's a really good question you ask. What about biodiversity? And as you say, we have lost a lot. It's so important in our systems, right? Like it's so important in our landscapes, the role it plays. And it's so important if you're in the business of producing food. So
because that one grass type that you mentioned could be fundamental for the health of that cow and the grazing system that was there. I mean, there are so many things we don't know in terms of interactions and more diverse and more complex, unfortunately, I mean, for your team, but more complex and more diverse in many cases is more resilient, like you mentioned at the beginning, and might uncover things and interactions that we had no clue about. And we only can find out if they're still there. And there might be some seeds hidden somewhere, but until the right management practice is applied, they won't come up because they need certain things that we, maybe the elders still remember, but we don't.
That's so true. And you know, the key in our business, in our extensive agricultural production systems, in our suite of assets, plants are just the key for us. Like without a diverse set of plants in our systems, we don't have soil health. Without these biodiverse, healthy plants, we don't have healthy animals. I mean, we can't produce, you know, healthy crops without our plants and soils being 100% healthy. So we need all this stuff. We need biodiversity in our systems. And so, you know, we talk about it all the time, you know, in our team, you know, plants are the key to this. And so I don't have all the answers around biodiversity. I just know that we've got to measure it, manage it, and try and enhance it. And so we, you know, we're working on this. Measuring it is not easy, but you got to start somewhere. We work with a lot of third parties and ecologists to help us get this done, but it's so important. And I think everyone's got a role to play in improving biodiversity.
And yeah, we will be hopefully paying a bit more attention on the podcast as well on this. And then I know you have some exciting news of that's why you're in a motel in Sydney. To actually focus, not only, I mean, it doesn't mean like this, a lot of this conversation was on North America, but it doesn't mean that you're no longer working in Australia. You're actually doing some very exciting work on a domestic fund in Australia. Can you share a bit more about it? I think it's early, but what triggered that instead of going from managed accounts for investors, I mean, mostly outside investors that want to invest in Australia, to raising the money up front, building a fund, and then deploying it? What triggered that that transition? Because it's a big transition as a team as well.
Yeah, so I guess the first thing to say is it's just offering another, for us, offering another product, because through separate managed accounts, that attracts a certain investor profile. But what it also does is it excludes other investors from the asset class and from our management and the outcomes that come from our management and those returns, both financial and environmental returns. So we wanted to open up a product to a larger segment of the market so that more investors could invest with us. We, you know, just from an efficiency and a return profile point of view, in Australian dollars, we couldn't really take in capital under, say, $10 million in a separate managed account. So what this is doing
that is... That reduces the market a bit, yeah.
It does. So therefore, by offering this new product to the market, which is a natural capital and real asset fund, it will just open it up to more and more investors and investors that, you know, want to have some exposure to the asset class but probably haven't had the capacity to go on their own in a separate managed account. So this fund will focus, as I said, on real assets in agriculture. We've got some future ambitions to bring in other things such as venture capital around ag tech and climate tech and also...
You talked about that before, yeah.
Yeah, and emissions reduction and even some financing options. I think we spoke about green finance and environmental finance. So that's in, say, years 2, 3, whatever. But first and foremost, real assets and carbon. And within that portfolio, there will be very succinct strategies there and some tactics in investing in real assets that operate livestock and carbon and others that do cropping, livestock and carbon, and then permanent tree crops and timber. So three real pillars to the real asset initiative to start with, and that's all about managing risk, driving financial returns, and I guess giving us some levers and tools to pull that will reduce our costs, but hopefully result in better outcomes and good carbon returns along the way, along with biodiversity and, you know, good financial returns. So that's the plan.
And what are your targets? When would you like to, I mean, what terms of size are you considering and when are you thinking of first close or something like that?
So, yeah, I think first close would be in the next 3 to 6 months. I mean, that's yet to really be defined. And the first close, you know, we would like to have $100 million raised by the end of this calendar year here in Australia. The longer term plan is to have $500 million under management in this fund. And that would, again, bring in probably the venture capital and the finance piece. In the short term, though, we'll try and, you know, first bite would be a $50 million investment to get out and get that deployed, start getting action on the ground, start baselining for carbon, getting the right people on the ground, getting the strategy deployed. So that's step one.
I think it's a perfect end of this check-in. I want to thank you so much for your time that this morning. Let's make sure it's not going to be another 3 years before we check in again. and to be able to follow, and thank you for sharing and allowing us as the podcast to follow your journey as it evolves and as it comes to fruition. Thank you so much for the work you do and for coming on here to talk about it.
Thanks, Cohen, and thank you as well. I mean, you're building fantastic awareness in this space. So just with the numbers you get on your downloads on your podcast, you should be proud of that. And we'll support you, pardon the pun, till the cows come home. So hope we get to see you soon. And thanks very much.
Thank you so much for listening all the way till the end. For the show notes and links discussed, check out our website, investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/post. Thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. For the show notes and links we discussed in this episode, check out our website, investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/posts. If you like this episode, why not share it with a friend or give us a rating on Apple Podcasts? That really helps. Thanks again and see you next time.